Okay, so thanks everyone saying something about it, and I think it's important to remember that when we're talking about the suttas, that we're talking about human beings, and that people in this room are all different, and that we respond to and relate to suttas in different ways. And it's not about being right, and it's not about getting the correct interpretation or anything like that, but it's about finding some wisdom which is going to help to inform your life and to help to inform the choices that you make in your life. So this is really the foundation for what we're doing. And for me personally, the thing that I love about the suttas is that personal and human element. And I find that they speak to like encounters between people, the Buddha and other people who, you know, come across each other and discuss things or have various kinds of encounters and so on. And I love that idea of that kind of raw dhamma that happens in the moment rather than something which is too processed and prepackaged. And so this is one of the things, like if you want something which is a like introduction to Buddhism, then it's not the easiest way to get an introduction to Buddhism. But there's plenty of books out there that you can do that. So with the suttas, it's not really organized like that. So it's more or less just kind of random access in many ways. You just kind of land somewhere and then see what happens. And it's not easy to find all of the different things. So even for myself, I still, you know, frequently can't remember where a particular sutta is or how to find it and these kinds of things. So we try to do some work to serve the community so that we can make it as available as possible. Okay, so that's one of my motivations. Right. So I'll just give you a brief summary of what we're doing on the website. So as you can see there, the name is sort of central, inspired by the central train station in Sydney. And I was going through them, thinking we need a wet name for this website. And then I'm like, oh, the trains are coming through here, they call it Central. So I thought, well, because of all the suttas are going through it, we might as well call it Sutta Central. So this is why it is, and it has something to do with that idea of the middle way and that kind of connection between everything. So when I was... So my own personal experience in the Dhamma, I really encountered the Dhamma from two main sources originally. Number one was a meditation retreat. I did a long Vipassana retreat, so that was where I encountered the experience of Dhamma in meditation. And then after that retreat, I started reading suttas. And that voice of the Dhamma that I read through the suttas, I found to be so beautiful and so powerful that I just really wanted to learn more about it. So that's really where I came from. Now, in Thailand, I was in Thailand at the time, and in Thailand during the 1990s and in the different monasteries, then it was very much a Theravada country. We've heard the word Theravada used a number of times. Now, personally, these days, I don't really consider myself to be Theravadan. I consider myself to be a student of the Buddha who, I was ordained in a Theravada tradition, but what I'm interested in is to learn what the Buddha taught. And of course, the Buddha didn't teach Theravada, he didn't teach Mahayana, and if you went to the Buddha and you said, which is best, Theravada or Mahayana, he'd say, I'm sorry, I don't know what you're talking about. So these are categories and systems which were developed at later times. It doesn't mean there's anything wrong with that, but it just means keep it into perspective, right? That's not actually what the Buddha's teaching is. It's not Theravada, it's not Mahayana. Both Theravada and Mahayana draw upon the Buddha's teachings. And so I was really interested in what lies underneath them. Now, the first thing and the most obvious thing that we encounter when we do that, and you look at that from within the Theravadan tradition, is you find the Pali Canon, the Pali Tripitaka. Okay? And we probably have some pictures down here. Let's see. I've always been meaning to get some more pictures of the Pali text, but we've probably got a few here. Okay, so there's an image of a Pali text. This is obviously quite a decorative text. It's a very fancy one from Myanmar, probably a Padimokkha text, I think. And you can see this is the how the texts were passed down, and probably in here, it might be more realistic. There's another Pali text again, Burmese script. The cover of it anyway. And here is another text in, I think this one, Gandhari. So this is a more realistic depiction of what these texts were passed down on the palm leaf manuscript. Oh, actually, sorry, this one is birch bark, not palm leaf. So these very ancient texts, which have been passed down for such a long time, and they contain some kind of wisdom. And one of the things that I think is very curious, I mean, when we look at ancient texts and sacred texts and things like that, of course, there's lots of different sacred texts all over the world, and all of them contain some kind of wisdom. Right? But what we've seen in the present day is that people have taken those teachings and they've used them to develop methods for meditation and for spiritual practice that have real and measurable benefits for millions and millions of people right across the world. And if you just stop and take a step back from it, you realize how strange this is. Right? I mean, how is this possible? Right? That we have this 2,500-year-old teachings, and you can take those teachings and then apply it in Dublin in 2019, and somehow it works. Yeah? It's very strange. There's really very little like that from the ancient world. So there's something about the way that the Buddha presented the teachings that communicates to us. And, you know, I think some of those things are quite obvious. The fact that the Buddha's teachings is largely, it's empirical. So it's based on the phenomena that you experience, the things that you experience, rather than being based on the acceptance of metaphysical beliefs. It's based on practice and how you live, rather than being based on some kind of authority figure or something like that. So there are many things about these teachings which you can see have really a pertinence and a relevance. And the power of these teachings in modern times has revolutionized Buddhism across the world, not just through making it possible for Western countries to practice Buddhism, but also has transformed the practice of Buddhism throughout Asia and traditional Buddhist countries as well. Something that we often might neglect or overlook, and we maybe think that there's actually no such thing as traditional Buddhist country, really, or traditional Buddhism, or nothing that you'd encounter. It's all massively changed in the last 100 years or so. And I mean, maybe if you climb to some remote mountain in the back of Bhutan or something like that, you'll find a traditional monastery that hasn't been touched by modernity, but I doubt it. You probably travel through the mountains on the back of a donkey for ages, and then you get there and want to say, please, you know, can I stay at the monastery? And they say, fine, here's your room, and by the way, here's the Wi-Fi password. Modernity has touched everything, and it's transformed Buddhism just as it has transformed everything else. So our idea of traditional Buddhism is, and not just that, it's an idea. But traditional Buddhism is flexible and it's changing. And always, within all Buddhist traditions, no matter what the background is, no matter what the country is, no matter what kind of practice that you're interested in, the Buddha's teachings, the original Buddha's teachings, are the wellspring that inspire all of this change. And going back to these teachings, looking at them and saying, hey, hang on, the Buddha said we should do this, but actually we're doing that. Right? This is what gives us a challenge. Right? It doesn't mean that we have this kind of fundamentalist idea that we have to literally do everything the same way that's done in the suttas, because the world has changed. I mean, human nature hasn't changed all that much, I don't think, but the world certainly has. So we're not going to do everything exactly the same. Right? I mean, I'm doing a PowerPoint presentation here. I mean, nothing about that in the suttas. So we adapt. But we look back to these teachings as some kind of inspiration and some kind of challenge and to raise questions. And I think it's really important. Like, I was really happy to hear, you know, people saying that they have these skeptical attitudes and so on about the suttas. And, you know, on one level we can debate, you know, rationally what is the kind of the degree of reliability or probability or authenticity of different texts and things like that. And that's in a sense an empirical discussion. But in terms of the attitude we have towards them, you know, it's not about a dogmatic acceptance of a particular body of scripture or anything like that. But for me, it's very much about developing a relation where you can find inspiration and connection and wisdom and a sense of joy through finding the Buddha's words. Now, I mentioned before when I was in Thailand, so in Thailand and other Theravadan countries, basically they only really deal with the Pali Tripitaka. And one of the things that I kind of discovered at that time was that there was more to life than Pali. I was like, what? It's crazy. No. And when you first hear about this thing, you become a lot of resistance. No, well, there's these other scriptures, and then people dismiss them. They say, oh, this is all Mahayana stuff, and it's all late, and it's all just mythology and fancy stories, and nothing has to do with what the Buddha taught. And there's something to that criticism. Yes, much of the literature in the Mahayana countries is quite late, no doubt about that. Much of it is lots of fancy stories and things like that. But there's also a lot of great Dhamma in there. And, oh, nothing wrong with fancy stories anyway. So we realize that the earliest Buddhist texts are not just the property of one particular school, but that they are the heritage of all the different traditions of Buddhism. And so around that time, so around end of the 90s, early noughts, then I was starting to try to research this. When I first came to Australia and I first got the internet, and I tried to research the agamas, because they have these things called agamas, which are like the Pali Nikayas, but they're in Chinese translation, right? Unfortunately, most of the search results I could get at that time were for a species of lizard called agama, so that didn't lead me all that far. But we realized that when the Buddhists went to China, that they took with them these scriptures and they translated them into Chinese. And they're actually pretty much similar to the texts found in Pali. Not identical by any means, but pretty much similar. And this was something which has been lost, unknown to the Buddhist tradition for thousands of years. So it's really worth just pausing for a moment and considering and remembering the significance of this. It really wasn't until the 19th century, when the English were in India, that they rediscovered the sacred sites of India. And I'm sorry, I know this must be very traumatic for you all, but it is true to say that not everything the English did was always bad. And they did do some good things. And one of them was that they rediscovered sacred sites in India, and they learned that there was a thing called Buddhism. Because before, it's not obvious, right? If you go to Sri Lanka and Tibet and Japan, it's not at all obvious that these are actually the same religions and that these are following the same teachings, because the external forms of the religions are often quite different. And so that they greatly realized, actually, no, these are actually branches of the same thing. And this was all put together more or less in the 19th century, and the kind of historical picture emerged from there. And a couple of scholars, Nanjio, a Japanese scholar, and Samuel Beale, an English scholar in China, missionary in China, began to realize that in the Chinese scriptures, they contained texts that are very similar to the texts which were recently published from the Pali scriptures of Sri Lanka. And of course, it's very curious. Why is this so, right? I mean, Japan and China is a long way from Sri Lanka, right? How come they've got these same things in there? And a bit later on, didn't take long before people realized that the same thing was true of the Tibetan scriptures. So there were things in Tibetan that actually were basically the same as the things we're finding in Pali. Not identical, but very similar. And so gradually the people put the pieces together and developed a historical picture that explained how this came to be. And so the general idea, or the basic idea, is that after the Buddha passed away, the community got together and recited the different texts. The community later spread out across India, and the textual collections diverged to some degree, and they ended up in these different places and were translated into these different languages. So basically, it's a common heritage which became sort of differentiated somewhat over time. And of course, from a scholarly point of view, the details of all of this, you know, are debatable and, you know, a subject of sort of scholarly dispute and so on. But the overall picture is, I think, fairly clear. So this is what we're dealing with. We're dealing with what we call the early Buddhist texts. So this is the texts which come from the period before Buddhism split into all of these different sects. And we deal with the texts in the original languages, which are Pali, Sanskrit, Chinese, Tibetan, and a few other languages like Tocharian and a few other things. And we deal with translations in modern languages. So we have, we have 47 languages now on Sutta Central. So we are hoping to, in fact, add Irish to it. We don't have Irish at the moment. But we do have a translation of the Metta Sutta into Irish by Ema has done one, so this is hopefully will be added on soon. But we do have a lot of other languages, such as Farsi, Hebrew, Indonesian, Klingon, Polish, and so on, Vulcan. It may be the case that some of the sort of central team might be geeks. Has been suspected. So this is what we're doing. So early Buddhist texts are this inheritance of literature, Pali, Chinese, Sanskrit, Tibetan, and other, and the translations in modern languages, and the parallels are the connections between them. So the parallels is where typically modern scholars have gone through all of these texts, and they say that this one is similar to that one, and then they make a note of it in some book somewhere, and these all gather together and put into tables, and then we list those things. And I'll just show you how that all works on Sutta Central. So a basic introduction, here's the website, and you can open the menu here, and you can find a sutta. Does anybody want to suggest the sutta that we can find? Anyone got a favourite sutta? Vajragatha Sutta, impressively obscure. Nice. Okay, so there's bunches of Vajragatha Suttas. Which one do we want?
I don't know.
We'll find a Vajragatha Sutta, okay? So we can find that one here. In fact, we can find that using search. We can find that using search. Vajragatha. And so Vajragatha, here we have a nice dictionary entry. Vajragatha is a wanderer who later became an arahant terror. True? Might not be true, actually. Anyway, several conversations he had with the Buddha are mentioned in the books and various suttas. There's a whole section on Vajragatha. So here we have many suttas with Vajragatha. And here's one of them. Why not? This is an interesting one. Actually, this one has been subject to quite a lot of scholarly debate and so on. So what I'll do. So we have different translations you can choose. We use my translations because they're the best. And because you can do cool things, like if you want to watch it the line by line with the Pali, you can go there and click a setting, and it goes to the settings menu, and you can now watch it Pali and translation. Nice, right? Yes, thank you. I'm looking for some validation here.
Thank you.
So when we were developing Sutta Central, we drew upon resources which have been developed, you know, that people have put all these things together, like typing up the Pali Tripitaka, right? I mean, it's a massive undertaking, and all of these things. But one of the problems that we had was that we didn't have a good, freely available English translation of all of the suttas, which is kind of crazy. Not even all the Pali suttas, not to speak of the Chinese and Sanskrit and Tibetan ones. And these things, they have all been translated, but the translations sometimes are caught up in copyright, sometimes they are sometimes they're not very good, or sometimes they may be incomplete, or they may be inconsistent, different people translating things in different way. So after exhausting all possibilities, I've tried to find a really good way to solve this problem, and I couldn't find a really good way to solve this problem. And as you do, eventually I said, bugger it, I'll do it myself. So that's what I did. And I went away for 2.5 years, stayed on an island off the coast of Taiwan, and translated Pali. So that was fun. So this is the translations that we have here. Let's have a look at the parallels. So we can open up, this gives us some details as it. You can see different translations, and this is the parallels. So you can see this particular sutta has two parallels. So what that means is that scholars have identified two cases in the whole corpus of Buddhist literature where, sometimes actually outside Buddhist literature, but usually inside the Buddhist literature, where there is another sutta which is similar or kind of the same or almost the same as this particular one. And typically the idea of a parallel is that we believe it's likely that they both descended from the same ancestral text. Okay, now we can't prove that, but that's the most reasonable explanation. And so here we have two parallels in Chinese. Let's have a look at them. Anyone here speak Chinese? You know that if this was a room full of Chinese people, and I said, if anyone here speaks English, then half of them would be able to speak English, right? It's kind of embarrassing, isn't it? Anyway, so, no one can speak Chinese. What shall we do? We are lost. We are bereft. We have no hope of knowing anything. Oh, hang on. No, we have Sub Central. Come to the rescue. So, there we go. So, this is why people ask me, do you speak Chinese? I say, no, but I can cheat. So that's what I heard. So this is a particular sutta, and that's just a number of the sutta, and that's what I heard. At one time, the Buddha was staying in Rajagaha at Vulture's Peak mountain. Oh, what's that? Epidendrum, steep bank. So this must be a proper name. So, proper name. At that time, Vatsiputriya. So, Vatsiputriya is called Vatsiputriya in Sanskrit. And so on. So, this is telling us. So, this is the parallel for that particular sutta. And even if you don't know Chinese, you can at least get some idea if you're looking at it using that kind of little magic tool. Unfortunately, it's still the case that there's many fewer translations in Chinese than there are in from the Pali. This one's not translated. This other one I don't think is translated. Let's see. No, that one's not translated. So we are working on that. We're working on getting translations from. From Chinese, but still very backwards. Yes.
Can we ask a question at the same time?
Please.
Okay.
Come on.
Do you have some dates on the project of translation of the Chinese by
Do I have what? Dates on it?
No,
I don't actually. I haven't heard about that for ages. I think Analio started a project to translate Samyutta Agama and kind of got distracted doing some other things. I haven't actually checked back with him for a while on that, so I haven't heard any updates on that for a while. Hopefully it'll still be completed. But I know that he was going to translate the Dirghagama as well.
And do you have someone in this personal volunteer team that starting to?
We do, yeah. We have two or three people who are interested to translate Chinese as well. Yeah, I mean, there's far too much for one person. So here's the Vatsiputriya Sutta. So we've already seen that this has two parallels in Chinese. And what that means is that there's a good... That means that this must have come from a time before these two schools of Buddhism were split. Right? Now most of the time the Chinese texts come from the northwest of India, the Pali texts come from the southeast of India in Sri Lanka. And yes, I can even kind of show you that another thing, which is nice. So, okay, so here, notice that this sutta just begins with Vajragupta going up to the Buddha and asking him. It doesn't have a setting. The Chinese sutta that we looked at had a setting, right? It said, that's what I heard, and the Buddha was staying in Rajagaha at the vulture's peak. So in these are the kinds of details that you often find will differ from one version to the other. And they are, incidental details of the setting and things like that may be abbreviated in one as opposed to the other. Now let's have a look at that setting. So Rajagaha, we can search for that. And here we come, Rajagaha. And we actually have a map. So that's nice, right? So we have a map that tells us where all of these locations are in India. So I have a map of Indian Buddhism, map of Buddhist sites. So that's cool, huh? This is a Google map. So this locates the country, so this is the nation of Magadha, and in here is Rajagaha, and the Vulture's Peak is in Rajagaha, and where's the Vulture's Peak? Can anyone spot it on the map? Oh, here, Vulture's Peak is Rajagaha, there. Anyway, it's one of these mountains around here. Oh, here we go, here's the Vulture's Peak. So this is the location of the map, which we can find on Google Maps, right? And that's Vulture's Peak. And then it gives you the description of it there. So one of the reasons that we wanted to do this map was because these are like real places. You know, this is not just all kind of made up stuff. And again, apologies, but this was something that the British actually found out. And they was interested. The history of these things is always interesting. There was the head of the Indian Archaeology Department, his name was Cunningham, and he got hold of the Chinese, accounts of the Chinese pilgrims. And the accounts of the Chinese pilgrims would say that they visited this particular place, and then they travelled this many leagues to the east, and then they found this place, and then they travelled this many leagues to the north, and they found that place. And Cunningham went and retraced those steps. And interestingly, he didn't even have the Pali Suttas with him at the time. Right? He didn't use the Pali Suttas to rediscover these things. It was only based on the Chinese texts. And yet, when they went there, they could actually dig these places up and found that they were all there. And so all of these sites that were talked about are actually real places. I think it's really important to recognize that, because when we're reading suttas, or reading a sacred scripture, it just sounds like it's kind of, you know, it might as well be in Narnia as it is in anywhere we are. So you can see here, this is also from the suttas, you can see that the Buddha's activities were very much located around this sphere, northern India and the Gangetic Plain. Few references to things outside of that area, but that's the whole area that he was living in and concerned about. So within about a couple of hundred years after the Buddha, Buddhism had spread down to Sri Lanka. So by the time of Ashoka, down to Sri Lanka, up to the northwest, to Afghanistan, and to the east as far as Bangladesh. So that was within 100 or 200 years of the Buddha.
Can I just ask?
Yeah, please.
You mentioned Cunningham there. He was an archaeologist?
Yeah.
An English archaeologist?
Correct.
So what kind of time was he working?
Late 19th century, early 20th century.
So they were archaeological sites already at that stage, like they were buried in a state to find them?
That's correct, yeah.
Okay. So he was able to locate a lot of them?
He located a lot of them. And that period they discovered the Indus Valley Civilization and lots of other things as well. Mm. Yeah.
I know, in Sri Lanka, it was the British who discovered a lot of the ancient sites as well,
that
have been over jungles.
Right, yeah. And they're just, you know, there might be some, you know, locals will know that there's something there, but they don't really know what it is. So, so that's the spread of Buddhism. In the Buddha's life, it was there. Within 100 and something years, it was there. And then another couple of 100 years after that, it would have spread to China. And then later on to Tibet. So the scriptures that we have, the early Buddhist texts, are mostly from either Sri Lanka people from around this region, Gandhara and Kashmir, and from there to China. Right. So, okay, so here's Vatugata. So let's read, this is only a short sutta, so let's read through the sutta. And so for those of you not familiar with suttas, you get some idea of the flavour of it, because it's a conversation. Then the Vatugata went up to the Buddha and exchanged greetings with him. The first thing that I like about this is that how approachable the Buddha was, right? He's not like sitting on some kind of obscure mountaintop or something like that. You don't have to go through some weird initiation process or anything like that. You just go up and say, g'day, how's it going? And when that's done, you sit to one side and then ask him a question. Right? And it's all very kind of unceremonial, very kind of plain. I mean, of course, there's some kind of wild and wonderful bits in there, right? But for the most part, they're very human interactions. So then he asks this question. Kinnukho bhogotama athattāpi. And this is quite a controversial question for various reasons. But the idea is, does the self exist or does the self exist absolutely? So the point here is, he's not asking a psychological question about whether you exist, but he's asking about this metaphysical self, right? This idea that you have like an eternal soul that lives forever. And that's kind of, he doesn't say that explicitly. The Pali literally just says, is there a self? Atata. But that verb form here, ati, has this implication it's just the verb to be. But it has this implication of being as an eternal or essential kind of being. Yeah? Indian languages have two verbs to be, bhavati, which is the more, means almost like to grow or to live, whereas ati means to exist in some essential sense. And so I've tried to convey that in my translation by saying, does the self exist absolutely? You might say something like, does the self exist, does the self essentially exist? Might have to be another way, maybe even a better way of translating that. When he said this, the Buddha kept silent. You have to remember that what you got was like super annoying. Okay? There's a few people here are teachers, right? Anyone here's a teacher? No? No one here's a teacher. You're a teacher, right? So you know what? You know some students, they're like always asking questions, right? And there's the difference between this. If a student asks questions, it's good, right? They're interested and it's great. But then they keep on going and going and going, and there's a certain point that comes where you're like, oh, please, just sit down. And so Vatugata had been to the Buddha. There's dozens of suttas where he's going to the Buddha and asking all of these kinds of questions. So when the Buddha's silent here, there's a whole context to it, right? And he said this, the Buddha kept silent. Then does the self not exist? Absolutely. For a second time, the Buddha kept silent. Then Vatugata got up from his seat and left. Yeah? Interesting kind of exchange, right? But again, remember within that context, there are many conversations that they've had before. Then not long after Vatugata had left, Venerable Ananda said to the Buddha. So, who can tell me? Who is Venerable Ananda?
His cousin, is he?
Right? The Buddha's favourite monk. I don't know if he had favourites, but if he had one, it would have been Ananda, yes. His attendant. And so here he is, attending to the Buddha, obviously. So, why didn't you answer Vatugata's question? Oh, I should mention something I didn't explain, but the Vatugata is said to be a wanderer. Okay? Paribhajaka. So that means that he is... Oh, can someone tell me what it means? What does wanderer mean?
Traveler?
Sorry?
Traveler?
A traveler? That's correct, yeah, that's right.
So there were a lot of people wandering around, spiritual seekers, I don't know what you call them, asking
them questions. Right, exactly, yeah. So yeah, it doesn't quite mean a traveller just in the sense of just like wandering generally, but it means he's a renunciate who's a member of one of these traditions. Sorry?
Spiritual
But he's like a you know, proper renunciate. He's like in India today they'd call like a sadhu or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
So we don't know exactly what tradition, like it's a fairly generic term. Might be somewhere else. Anyway. But that's, I think, also important background to understand, that when he asks this question, that he has his own assumptions that he's bringing to it. So, why didn't you answer his question? Ananda, when Vachagata asks me whether the self exists absolutely, if I had answered that the self exists absolutely, I would have been siding with the ascetics and Brahmins who are eternalists. So the phrase ascetics and Brahmins is a stock phrase that refers essentially to the whole range of spiritual seekers, philosophers, teachers, and so on. And the idea of eternalism essentially is anyone who posits the idea that I, in my essence, will live forever. Okay, so if somebody tells you, if you believe in Jesus, you will go to heaven and live with God forever, then that's eternalism. Okay, so that's the kind of idea. It's not the only kind of eternalism, many others. In India, one form of eternalism was like that. Another form of eternalism was the idea that your essence, your Atman, is and always has been one with the divine cosmos, which is Brahman. Yeah? There's another form of eternalism. So there's many different ways, but this is saying that if I believe that the self exists absolutely, this kind of idea of existence as essential and eternal. When Vachagata asked me whether the self does not exist absolutely, if I had answered that the self does not exist absolutely, I would have been siding with the ascetics and Brahmins who are annihilationists. Now this one's a little bit harder to tease out or to parse out, and I'm not at all confident in my translation of this. It's a bit hard. It's a hard one to translate and get the sense across. But the idea here is an annihilationist is somebody who believes that basically, they believe that this life is all there is. I mean, they might believe that there's more life. Some annihilationists might say you've got like 27 lives. I mean, this is ancient India, right? Like, basically any philosophy you can think of, somebody made a philosophical school for it, all right? So there's lots of variety in the beliefs that people have. But the most common form of annihilationist would be a materialist view that this life is all there is. At the end of this life, we're finished. And you go back to the elements, and that's it. Okay? So, now here the opposite of the idea of does not exist absolutely, the idea here is that it's not quite saying that yourself does not exist. What it really means is that yourself exists, but then it's going to come to an end. Right? But yourself does not exist in an absolute sense, does not exist in an essential or eternal sense. Does that make sense? Yeah? So this word ati to mean to be is used in a very kind of philosophically pregnant and specific sense in these kinds of texts. Yeah, so clearly he's not saying that there's no such thing as who I am, but he's saying that this thing that I am will finish at the end of our life. Okay, so if Vachagata had asked me whether the self exists absolutely, if I had answered that the self exists absolutely, would that have helped give rise to the knowledge that all things are not self? So here the Buddha is giving like another answer. He's already answered the question, and now he's giving another set of answers to the same question, that all things are not self. So of course this is one of the foundational teachings of Buddhism, and the Buddha very famously taught that all conditioned things are impermanent, that all conditioned things are suffering, and that all things, all dhammas, are not self. Right? And I said before that this passage is controversial, and I think one of the reasons is that there always seems to be this need, no matter how many times the Buddha kept on banging on about not self. We all have a lot of attachment. And we always try to sneak a self back in there somehow, in one way or another. So the Buddha says, well, all things are not self. So how can we say that the self exists absolutely, not compatible? But this is getting more of a pragmatic pragmatic one? Is it sort of conforming or conducive to this idea? Then when Wajagatta had asked me whether the self does not exist absolutely, if I had answered that the self does not exist absolutely, Wajagatta, who is already confused, would have got even more confused, thinking, it seems that the self that I once had no longer exists. Right? So again, you can see that this idea that to say that it doesn't exist, it doesn't mean that it somehow it just isn't, it means that it kind of is and then it finishes. Yeah, it doesn't exist in an eternal or an absolute sense. And so the Buddha's like already fully informed of Wajagatta's confused state of mind, and he doesn't want to contribute to it. So sometimes best just to leave it. And Wajagatta will go away and stew for a while. And the Buddha, when the Buddha will stay silent and he let him go away, he knows he's going to be back. Right? Again, this is a really important context. You can't just look at that and thinking the Buddha wasn't answering his questions. Because Wajagatta was constantly coming and asking questions.
Mm-hmm.
He knows he's going to be coming back, but there's not really an answer that he can give at that point in time that's going to be helpful for him. Alright?
Does he continue on about he both exists and doesn't exist?
No.
And neither exists nor doesn't exist?
Not in this particular one, but in other discourses to Wajagatta it does. Yeah.
Does exist mean different? Is that different from manifest?
I think so, yeah. In this sense, yeah. Yeah, so to manifest is to appear, which implies something impermanent.
Yes.
Whereas to exist means it just is. It is essentially. I mean, you can see it's not dissimilar from the Catholic conception of God, you know, that God sort of exists essentially and eternally, he just is. Yeah. But for the ancient Indians, they were much more concerned about the metaphysics of the soul. And the metaphysics of God or divinity, in a sense, was, well, God's just he's just another being, right? So his existence is the same as ours.
Right.
Yeah.
Unchanging and eternal.
Unchanging and eternal, yeah. According to the Brahmanical or Hindu system, yeah.
Yeah, in some areas they make a distinction between being and becoming.
Right, yeah, similar kind of distinction.
The manifest, ever-changing, transient world.
Exactly, yeah. And basically, you know, you can use that to sum up the Buddha's teaching, right? The Buddha's teaching said, don't worry so much about being and focus more on becoming.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, because that's it. World to be experienced.
Sorry, would you just say?
You could sum up the Buddha's teaching by saying that the Buddha said, don't worry so much about the idea of being, but focus more on becoming. Because becoming is the transient world that we actually experience.
Would it try to be the other
way around? No, indeed not.
I mean, the becoming is the transient.
Yes.
I would have felt that putting one's store in the karma is rather than the transient.
That's the point. That there isn't anything that's permanent. Yeah?
But anything that is permanent and unchanging, not transient.
Right. That's right, yeah. So there isn't anything that's impermanent. There isn't anything that's permanent.
Mm.
So you're seeking for something that isn't there.
There's no thing that is permanent.
But there is something that's called the unconditioned, though.
Is there? There is something that's called the unconditioned.
Well, there is a word, the unconditioned, the unborn, the deathless.
Right.
You have come across these words.
What do you think that means?
What I think it means is that Buddha recognized the transient, impermanent nature of all physical existence, you know, and our experience here in the physical world. But the reason we could accept it is because there was something underlying it that was unchanging.
There's something underlying it with unchanging.
There's no it exists outside space and time, so it's impossible to
stay in
space.
It exists outside space and time.
No?
But is that written in any of your your suttas? There is the unborn, the unborn.
Not my suttas.
Yeah.
Is that written anywhere? Because I've had that quote to me by somebody,
yeah.
And I said, you know, I mean, I know it's to do with Nirvana.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
And that, but
let's have a look.
Have you come across it in a translation?
Of
in
course.
In a
sutta? Sure, of course. Let's have a look. Okay, so this is good because these are questions that people come up with a lot of the time. So I'll just, for those of people not familiar, I'm probably zipping through it a little bit too quickly.
Mm-hmm.
Let's have a bit of a look. We have a menu, suttas, vinaya, and abhidhamma. Who can tell me what the suttas, vinaya, and abhidhamma is?
Abhidhamma.
The abhidhamma is about the advanced psychology, isn't it?
Yeah.
Something like that?
The rules.
Okay, so Vinaya is the code of conduct for monks and nuns,
yeah.
But also has a lot of other fun stuff as well.
Yeah, I heard some fun stories.
Oh yeah, a lot of the Vinaya, I believe, is composed of stories that they told to keep the young monks awake in the back of the room. Back in the class, they're falling asleep. Well, what? and the suttas. That's pretty much what we've been looking at, right? So the discourses. Okay, so if we open that up, the suttas, we get a bunch of different things. And so this is the long discourses, the middle discourses, linked discourses, numbered discourses, minor collections, and other. Various other things which are there. And the green dots mean that there is a translation in your language. Okay, so that's what the green dots mean. You can choose a language from up here. Unfortunately, it's probably not going to work because it broke, and so that's embarrassing. But what is that language? You know what that language is?
Croatian.
Okay. So if there are translations in your language, just choose Hebrew. But I'm not exactly sure if it works. It seems to be broken at the moment. Yeah. Which hopefully. Anyway, so I think it just works for English. So anyway, ideally, you choose your language and then it will show up as a green dot telling you where there are translations in your language. Okay, so we open that, we have these different collections, and English translations are quite well represented. So the text we're looking for is in the minor collection, which is the Khuddaka Nikaya. So there's a few different things in here, so this includes Dhammapadas and various other things. And the Khuddaka Nikaya is here. A bunch of books in the Khuddaka Nikaya, and one of them is the Uddana. And one of the chapters of the Uddana, I think it's in this chapter. Right. So, obviously, that navigation is good if you know what you're doing, right? But, of course, it's terrible if you don't know what you're doing. So, what do you do? Well, let's try it. There's no simple solutions for any of these things, but let's try it. You said there's something about the unborn. Right? Bit hard because we don't know exactly how the translator is translated and things like that, but there we go. Bingo! There we go. About the unborn. That wasn't hard, was it? That was really lucky. Okay, so third discourse about Nibbana. So there's a few discourses about Nibbana. This is in a collection called the Uddana. So the Uddana is one of the early Buddhist texts, and I see in the collection, it's here, again, just to take you back where we went through. It's under the suttas, yeah? In suttas, the minor discourses in the Khuddaka Nikaya is the Uddana. Beautiful book, actually. A lot of really lovely suttas and things like that in the Uddana. However, it's worth mentioning that it is generally considered to be a little bit later than the bulk of the suttas in the main Nikayas. Not necessarily much later, but maybe a little bit later.
I heard the Sutta Nipata was early. Do you think that too?
No. This unfortunately is a very misleading idea that's got popular around the place, but don't believe it.
I'm interested to hear what you say, because everyone seems to be translating it for a while, saying that it was early.
Yeah.
Well, three people
when you say everyone. Well, let's have a look at that in just a minute. Shall we do that? We'll have a look at this sutta first, and we'll come to the Suttanipata in just a minute. Very good. So this is one that I haven't translated. So this was done by a monk called Venerable Ananda Jyoti, who's a very good friend of mine, and a very lovely monk, and a very good translator. So he... let's briefly read the sutta. Thus I heard, at one time the Gracious One was dwelling near Savatthi in Jetta's wood at Ananda Pindika's monastery. Then at that time the Gracious One was, that's of course just the Buddha, was instructing, rousing, enthusing, and cheering the monks with a Dhamma talk connected with emancipation. Those monks, after making it their goal, applying their minds, considering it with all their mind, were listening to Dhamma with an attentive ear. And again, you know, to me, you know, it's not just about like what the thing is, right? But it's about the context, it's about the place. And you can just imagine that environment. I can imagine going to listen to a Dhamma talk by the Buddha in the Jetta's Grove. And you sort of go there at night and all the monks will be around there and everyone will be around listening. Like the Buddha's talking. Oh, the Buddha's talking about Nibbana. Wow, everyone has to go. It'd be really exciting. Then on that time, the Buddha uttered this exalted utterance. So this is like a stock phrase for these kinds of things. So this is a class of literature, a genre of literature, where we have the udana, where we have a short narrative introduction leading up to some particularly inspired saying, usually a verse, although in this case, it's a short prose passage. There is monks. An unborn and unbecome, unmade, unconditioned. If, monks, there were not that unborn, unbecome, unmade, unconditioned, you could not know an escape here from the born, become, made, and conditioned. But because there is an unborn, unbecome, unmade, unconditioned, therefore you do know an escape from the born, become, made, and conditioned.
How late?
I do not know, and personally I don't have any problem with thinking that this was something that the Buddha said, but yeah, I just sort of mentioned that in passing. Even if the collection, the Udana, is a bit late, typically what happens with this kind of literature, and this is a very common feature of Indian literature in general, was you'd have some kind of kernel, some kind of core saying, which might be a verse or something which you'd memorize, and then that's surrounded by a somewhat more flexible narrative framework. So even if the book itself is somewhat late, the main thing that's been elaborated would be that narrative framework, and the actual core teachings tend to be preserved word for word from an early time. I can't say that that's the case in this particular case, but that's usually the situation. I haven't actually studied this particular text from a historical point of view, so I can't really say. I'll just see. Okay, one thing we can say, look at the parallels. We have parallels? We do have parallels. A bunch of Chinese parallels. We have parallels actually in some Sanskrit. Interesting. Like I said, I haven't studied it. Okay, I'll have a look at that in just 1 second. But does this confirm what you were saying before?
Yes, basically, yeah. It wasn't like I wasn't making the claim. I know this is just what I learned. But this is it. Yeah, this is.
This is the passage you were talking about. Yeah.
Yeah.
Does anyone have any thoughts about this? What does it imply, or what can we?
We can escape from the from binds and strictures. So.
I mean, that's the point of it, right? So he's pointing out that we can have some escape. Yeah,
mm-hmm.
I think that's right.
Yeah.
It's interesting that it's all phrased in a negative form, right?
Yeah,
there is. And not.
Because from my experience, anyway, personally, like, it is something that there is no words for. Because I heard this described at this one time, that language itself is part of the conditioned world, so that if we try to put this into language itself, it's forming a relationship becomes an
issue. Right. Yeah. And this is why the Buddha had this linguistic strategy. Most of the time when he talked about Nibbana, he talked about it in these negative forms.
Yeah.
Actually, the Buddha had a twofold strategy when talking about Nibbana. It's quite very, very subtle, as you might expect. When he talked about, if you like, the ontology of Nibbana, like whether Nibbana was real or not, then he used negative terms. There is the unborn, unmade, unconditioned, and so on. But when he talked about the psychology of Nibbana, it's the peaceful, the secure, the refuge, the ultimate bliss.
Mm.
So he painted it psychologically in these glowingly positive terms, right? To draw you towards it, make you interested. What is this thing? Yeah?
Mm-hmm.
But when he talked about what it is, he'd always undermine it. It's not this, it's not this, it's not this. So that you can't turn it into a thing that you can get attached to.
It's the very same as
of course, yeah, attachment will always find a way. Yeah.
But it's the very same as Neji, not this, not that, and that's Indian. And in Hebrew it's the ineffable or Yahweh or something.
Right.
And so it seems to be the same kind of meta concept.
It is. I mean, there are, of course, a lot of similarities. I mean, when there are differences, of course, like with the Buddha and his teaching on... This was summed up, actually, nicely by Maurice Walsh in his introduction to the Digha Nikaya. And he said that if you look at what the Buddha said about the unconditioned, then many of the things that he said about the unconditioned could equally be said of theistic ideas, so could equally be applied to God. However, the difference is that when people talk about God, they typically add other things to the concept.
Mm-hmm.
And those other things are the things that wouldn't be acceptable to from a Buddhist point of view. So, for example, that God is the creator of the world.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah? Or even, maybe when you said before, that it's like a foundation that underlies the world.
Mm-hmm.
Right? That's nothing actually saying something like that. Yeah?
Sure.
So that's something which is, again, being read into it.
Mm.
So,
But I mean, I would assume that, like, well, I know that this exists, you know, the unconditioned being born, etc.
Right.
And that people experience this, you
right.
know, through all kinds of different practices in different religions. They all end up in the same place, but by different route.
Mm.
So they try and conceptualize it in some way that makes sense to them, you know. All kinds of mystics of all kinds. And every description is inadequate, you know,
right.
by definition,
right.
really.
Right.
So that's why I think that Jimmy says that it has echoes and resonances in other religions as well, because it exists.
And the main thing, again, is if you know, none of these teachings are taught in order to for us to sit around and argue about the teaching, but they're there to draw us towards an experience.
Mm-hmm.
That's why I suppose when you mentioned ontology, I didn't think the teachings were concerned with ontology.
Well, they're not sort of formally concerned with ontology, but they do deal with whether certain kinds of things exist or don't exist.
Ontology meaning?
Ontology is the philosophy of being.
Okay.
So if you say there is an unborn, then that's an ontological statement of a sort.
I've never thought of
yeah.
that way before.
Yeah. But it's certainly true that Buddhist philosophy generally emphasized epistemology rather than ontology.
Mm.
Yeah. How do you know things is more important.
Because I just actually happened to listen to a podcast about Schopenhauer today, who I knew less than nothing about before I listened to it.
Okay.
And he was influenced a lot by the Vedanta and Buddhism, you know?
Yeah.
And he came up with this idea basically that, you know, the cause of so much of our suffering is desire and wanting from one,
right.
you know. But he didn't seem to have the next step, which was how to escape from it, you know.
Okay.
I've only listened to one podcast, so I'm not an expert in children. But like, that's always struck me, you know. Even like in feminist literature and discourse analysis and that, they deconstruct everything, you know, deconstruct
right.
self,
right.
society, everything.
Right. Right.
Which is really empowering, you know.
Right.
But then there's nothing to put in its place, you
right.
know, whereas
mm-hmm.
the Buddha gave
right.
you know, just something else.
Yeah.
What was on the other side?
Yeah. Yeah, I think it's very, very true. And it's a really interesting passage on that in David Hume. He basically talks about the self, and he says, like, if you try to perceive something which you can see as who you are, when you look closely at it, you realise it's just a series of thoughts and reflections and memories, and it's always changing, and there's nothing really there. But he says, you can do that, and you can be completely convinced that there is actually no inherent self or no abiding self inside you, but I can guarantee you that in 5 minutes you will have got up from this seat and completely forgotten all that,
mm-hmm.
and be acting as if the self was still there.
Mm-hmm.
Right? So again, it's that idea that the insight, the wisdom is there, but because there's no meditation,
mm-hmm.
right? The ability to hold that in your mind and to realize it at a deeper and deeper level, and it becomes transformative. It's not just about the idea of not self, it's about the transformative power of the idea.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so we were, somebody brought up the topic of the Sutta Nipata, so why don't we have a bit of a look at that? I actually had a few things that I wanted to look at today, but I'm much happier looking at things that you want to look at. It's much more
I'm
fun.
I'm curious about what you want to do. I have no attachment to the Sutta Nipata.
You have no attachment to... Well, we'll look briefly at the Sutta Nipata then. Okay, so we were in the same place as we were before in the suttas, under the minor discourses and the Kodaka Nikaya, we now have the Sutta Nipata. So the Udana we were just looking at is up here, Sutta Nipata is down there. So quite somewhat closely related books. And Sutta Nipata has a number of chapters. We have actually this menu, I'm kind of embarrassed by this menu. It should all be in translation, but it's kind of tricky to translate things.
The part that tried was early was the Ataka Bhaga.
Right, now we're talking. Okay. So before you said thus you have heard, yes. So there are, of these chapters, a number of chapters which are widely regarded as being early chapters. However, the Sutta Nipata as a whole is not necessarily early because it's comprised of different bits.
Mm-hmm.
And some of those bits, yes, are early and some of those bits are not. That is the part that often gets overlooked. And I'll show you an example of exactly that if I can find the sutta that I'm looking for. Okay. So let's have a look, first of all, at some of the, at a typical text of what's considered to be the early portion of the Sutta Nipata. Leave that one behind. Sorry, just close a few tags. And the Ataka Bhaga is known for its very powerful and straightforward teachings. And I'll just find a typical Ataka Bhaga teaching here. Okay, so here is a teaching from the Ataka Bhaga. So this is one of the chapters of the Sutta Nipata. And this is one of the typical and quite distinctive teachings we find in this sutta. Whoever should take to himself certain views, thinking them best, supreme in the world, and hence he proclaims all others as low, by this he does not become free of disputes. In whatever is seen by him, heard and cognized, by vows and rites alone, he sees profit in these, and so from his grasping at that very view, all others he sees as worthless and as low. Intelligent people declare it as a bond, if relying on one, he sees others as low. Therefore, should a bhikkhu rely not on rites, on vows, on the seen, the heard, and cognized? And so in this world, let him fashion no views relying on knowledge, rites, and vows done, nor let him conceive that he's on a par, nor think himself low, nor higher than them. abandoning own views, not grasping at more, and even in knowledge not seeking support among those who dispute, he never takes sides to the various views he does not recourse. Having no bias for either extreme, for being or not, here, the next world, for a bhikkhu like this, there's no settling down among dhammas seized and decided by them. Concerning the seen, the heard, and the cognized, not the least notion is fashioned by him. That one, who's perfected, grasps at no view. By whom in the world could he be described? Neither they're fashioned nor honored at all, those doctrines, they're never accepted by him. Perfected, not guided by rites or by vows, one thus not returning, beyond he is gone. So there's a translation here by Venerable Kantipala.
So what's the title of that one again?
That one is called The Eight on the Ultimate, the Paramattaka Sutta. Yeah. So, right? So very...
If everybody in the world just adopted that type, imagine how different the world would be.
Well, I mean, forget the world. What about Twitter? Sorry? Are you kidding?
Oh, well.
Twitter is absolutely killing people. Yeah, but anyway. Sorry?
The eight,
so the Aptika is like, it's eight verses. So it's
eight verses
on the ultimate. So, yeah, and you can see, so this is very characteristic of this section of the Sutta Nipata, right? So very much about undermining the idea of holding on to views, about the freedom that comes when you let go of attachment to the idea that I'm right. A few little just points of detail that I'll just note here. We have this set of ideas which is found in a number of places here. What is seen, heard, and cognized. Normally is a group of four, seen, heard, thought, and cognized. And this is like a set of ideas which, it's not just about what you've seen, like the literal sense faculties in this particular case, but what it is about how we come to know of philosophical or religious or spiritual teachings. Okay, so it's an epistemological teaching. We learn about these things either from seeing, so in modern days, reading. In those days, seeing actually referred to like the vision of a monk, an ascetic, an enlightened one, which we get some kind of inspiration or some kind of transmission or something from the sight of an ascetic. So here, obviously, you hear the teachings. To cognize is to think about them. To think about it, and mutta is to reflect on it and to analyze it, and to know, to cognize, is to experience something that yourself. So your religious and philosophical views come from any of these kinds of things. Okay? Vows and rites, of course, these things very common in the religious milieu that the Buddha was born into. Alright? So this is one of those texts in the Aptikavagga, and for a variety of reasons scholars agree that these suttas are quite early, one reason being because of the language and the style, but also because of the fact that they are quoted to and referred to in a number of other suttas. And they also shared with the Chinese texts, like not all the Sutta Nipata is found in the Chinese, but the Aptikavagga is. There are good reasons for thinking that this is early. However, most of those things also apply to the prose texts. There are some people who have almost like a sort of Aptikavagga fundamentalism, where you basically throw out all the suttas, and only the Aptikavagga is the only actual teaching of the Buddha. Which I think is a bit excessive. Yeah. So this thing that, yes, there's a number of places in the suttas that are quoting from the Aptikavagga, but the suttas actually quote from each other all the time. So that's not as significant as you might imagine. So that's one of the books in the Sutta Nipata. Let's have a look at another sutta in the Sutta Nipata. Mm, no, that's not Okay, so this is another text in the Sutta Nipata. Okay, so here is, I'll just read part of this sutta. In midday meditation, the sage Asita saw brilliantly arrayed the thrice ten Deva troop, happy and joyful, waving flags the while with Sakka their superior, all highly elated. Then, when he had seen the Devas so delighted, respectfully, he greeted them and questioned them like this. Why is this Deva Sangha, this body of Devas, so exceedingly joyful? They brought banners for brandishing about. Even when the Devas battled the demons and won, then there was no such celebration. So what have the Devas seen? What wonder are they seeing? Why are the gods so delighted? They whistle and they sing, clap hands and they strum sitars with dancing and with music. So they celebrate. O you Deva dwellers on Meru's airy peaks, I beg you, good sirs, soon dispel my doubts. Now, I don't know about you, but it seems to me this is a slightly different mood happening here than we had in the earlier text, right? And you might be wondering how this goes on, right? A bodhisattva has been born in a Sakyan city in lands along Lumbini, precious gem beyond compare for the weal and welfare of those in the human realm. That's why we're delighted and completely overjoyed. He, best being of all, foremost among mankind, mighty bull among men, of creatures all supreme, will revolve the wheel in ancient seers' woods, likened to a roaring lion, mightiest of beasts. Right? It's all very intense, yeah? Yeah, it's all very intense. Anyway, so it kind of goes on like that. So it's this very kind of effusive and joyous celebration of the birth of the Buddha. And if you suspect that perhaps this might be a somewhat later text, then your suspicions would probably be correct. But just briefly, if you look at the Pali text for this, one of the reasons, how do we know things are early or late? You can read that text, it doesn't sound like a particularly realistic description of something, right? But one of the reasons that we know is because in India, all of the verse texts have a meter. Right? They have a particular rhythm, just like in English language they have rhythms. But those rhythms changed and evolved over time. And we know something about the history of those rhythms. Ananda jate tirasagane patite sakkancha indang suchivasane chadeve dusang hetwa atirivat homayante isito isi adasa diva vihare. So this kind of metta is very late and quite... we can tell that they're very late because they're constructed on quite an artificial and formalized scheme. The earlier kinds of verses were more flexible, more organic, more like folk music. Right? The later ones are more like classical music, if you like. It's everything's there and everything has to fit in the right way. So this is one of the many, many means that text critical scholars use to be able to ascertain the dating. So this is why I think it's incorrect to say that the Sutta Nipata is early, because it contains early and late elements. But certain things like the Atikawaga and other parts are indeed quite early.
Is it kind of Mahayana? Is it kind of...
Well, on the way, right? Yeah. I mean, you can see something in that if you read the Mahayana Sutras, that they take this even to a much further degree, right? So that, I mean, this is still somewhat restrained, you know, it's only a paragraph or two extolling the Buddha's virtues. In the Mahayana text it might be pages.
Mm-hmm.
So, but you can see that there's that same tendency there to
exaggerate, be flowery.
Be very flowery. I mean, it's like...
It would hold its own against other religions, for sure.
Sorry?
It would hold its own with other religions, you know.
Right. And I think... I mean... Mahayana as a description of the life of the Buddha is kind of like Harry Potter as a description of life in an English public school. I mean, yes, it's something like that in some ways. They had classes and uniforms and some things like that. But there's a lot of stuff in there which is more imaginative than it is historical. Which again, it's not to say that there's anything wrong with it, but it's just a different kind of literature, that's all. Okay, so I might just Any other questions? I was like going to talk about something, but any other questions? Thoughts? No?
Well, I do have a question. We discussed a little bit during the weekend that, of course, it's hard to keep texts for a long time in that climate.
Okay.
But I definitely would be interested to any philologist or archaeologist actually, and about the history of the physical texts and if there is any connection between them, because what we've seen now is the philology in terms of language, metrics, etc. So I wonder if there is any parallel research in that direction as well.
Okay, so in terms of the manuscripts, yes, there is research in that area. So in the Pali manuscripts, the Pali texts that we use today are derived from manuscripts of the 18th and 19th century. Right? Now, the oldest manuscripts that exist, we actually already saw an image of that earlier, but I'll just go back to that, where I find that, are the Gandhari manuscripts. So this is the Gandhari manuscript. I'm not sure exactly that particular one, but the Gandhari manuscripts are nearly 2,000 years old. Yeah? And so these are recovered from Afghanistan or modern-day Pakistan. They're made of birch bark. Often they are recovered from... often these things just appear on the black market, right? And they just show up. And scholars try to get hold of them and figure out if they're authentic or what's going on. I mean, sometimes they come from proper archaeological digs, but not always. These ones, the Gandhari texts, are mostly recovered from jars which were dug up. And when they dug them up, one of the curious things about it was that on the... You can see the different leaves that they had. So there'd be like a bundle of leaves. And on the front of the bundle of leaves, somebody had written the word Likhitam. And the word Likhitam means written. Okay? So imagine that you get a book, and on the cover of the book, someone's written on the cover of the book. It's a bit weird, isn't it, right? And they're kind of trying to figure out exactly what it means. But they realize that what it means is copied. So these are actually all the old books from the monastery library that were getting a bit tatty and a bit worn, so that they copied them, wrote Likhitam, and then put them in jars and then kept them underground to keep them safe. So and they're the ones we've got. What we've actually got is the discarded old library books. So they're already old when they got stored. So these ones are very ancient. So in Pali, we don't have any texts that are so ancient, but we do have... yes, go on.
Why do you think there is almost no manuscript from India? I mean, why? Because there must have been a lot of them until the third century. And so why is there like nothing? Is it because they've been like...
They were burnt by the Muslims.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's
surprising
that nobody even had a few. Yeah, they were pretty.
A lot of the because I think the Buddhist sites were very the accounts by the Islamic invaders tell of how they murdered all of the monks and burnt all the books. So this is not something from a Buddhist source, which is, you know, partisan or anything. This was from the Muslim historians who were celebrating their wiping out of these pagan or these horrible religions. And I think that the Buddhist monasteries were quite visible targets. You know, they're kind of big places and, big recognizable institutions. So I think people probably weren't like keeping manuscripts at home, and so they were kept in these big libraries like at Nalanda and places like that, and they made a pile and burnt it for like a week. So that the Sanskritic texts that we have are derived from occasional findings, either in monasteries in Nepal and Tibet, okay, a few bits and some from Japan, others from taken up from the desert or various kinds of chance findings like this, but there's no for one. So this one here, this is a project that sort of Central is undertaking at the moment. This is a 13th century manuscript of a book of a Pali text called the Chulavaga. And the this is the oldest Pali manuscript in existence. So there's a few pages and a few scraps that are older than this, but this is the oldest complete manuscript. And you can see from here, I'm just going, oh, that's not basic as well, let's try this. You can see from here that it's a beautiful cover design. It's very beautifully preserved, and that the writing is also very nicely preserved as well.
What script is that?
So this is early modern Sinhala script.
And if a
Sri Lankan person can read that script, and it's not too different from modern Sinhala. A few of the letter forms are a bit different and so on, but the language is Pali, and the script is Sinhalese.
How old is this one?
13th century. That we can date it. It's dated on three grounds. The first one is it has a colophon, that is, has a remark by the scribe at the end of the at the end of the manuscript that says it was copied under the instructions of King Parakamabahu, who was Dutiya Parakamabahu, who lived in the 13th century. So this is one way.
Mm-hmm.
The second way is from the writing style, so this can also be dated to the 13th century. And the third one is from the artistic style. So that particular art style, I was in the Colombo Museum, and the expert from the Department of Archaeology was there, and he took one look at that and said, oh, that must be 13th century, because in the 14th century the art styles changed drastically.
Mm-hmm.
It would be great to do carbon dating as well, but unfortunately we couldn't get the cooperation of the museum to do the carbon dating.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's in the museum in Colombo.
It's in the museum in Colombo, yeah.
You said
you're
such a central art involved in this project.
Are
they translating?
We are transcribing it. So we're making a digital edition of this particular text.
Okay.
Yeah.
I thought I'd mentioned there's a collection of later ones
that
the Czech
Museum
has displayed.
Yeah, we should mention that.
Yes.
Collection of manuscripts, which
is
a free exhibition
of the museum. We are getting near the end. Let me just briefly introduce one more text of what I was going to talk about, and this was about the councils, because this topic came up the other day. Does anybody know what we talk about when we talk about the councils, the Buddhist councils? Huh?
Right. To agree upon the teachings,
I guess. Yep. Pretty much. That's it. Yeah. And so the account of that is found in the book called the Chulavaga, actually the same manuscript we just looked at. And here's the chapter that deals with it. But what's interesting is if you compare what the Buddha himself says, and if I haven't closed that one, I believe I have closed that one. Let me just check this one again. So this is a discourse where the Buddha himself addresses this issue. And I'll just very briefly give you the background of this. So during the Buddha's life, we mentioned earlier the Shramanas, who were the followers of different groups. One of those Shramana groups was the Jains. And the founder of the Jains, Nigantanathaputta, had recently died. And when he did that, his followers, according to the Buddhist account, were all arguing with each other. Whether that's the case or not, I can't say, but that's what the suttas say. And Venerable Ananda, who again we have already met, went with another monk called Chunda to tell the Buddha about this. And the Buddha goes on to give some various teachings, basically saying that if the teacher is enlightened and everybody practices in accordance with the teaching, then that wouldn't happen. So in a way, you know, the Buddha, this is towards the end of the Buddha's life, right? And it's part of a cycle or a series of discourses where the Buddha is reflecting on what are the conditions that's going to happen when he's passed away. And So here the Buddha talks about his own spiritual path and teaching. As you can see, there's quite a lot to it. But I will just give you the ending part here. So the Buddha says, "I'm a teacher who's arisen in the world today, perfected and fully awakened. The teaching is well explained and well propounded, emancipating, leading to peace, proclaimed by someone who is fully awake. My disciples have inquired about the meaning of that good teaching, and the spiritual practice that's entirely full and pure has been disclosed and revealed to them with all its collected sayings, with its demonstrable basis, well proclaimed wherever there are gods and humans. I am a teacher today who is senior, long-standing, long gone forth, advanced in years, and have reached the final stage of life. I have today disciples who are competent senior monks, middle monks, junior monks, senior nuns, middle nuns, junior nuns, celibate laymen, laymen enjoying sensual pleasures, celibate lay women enjoying sensual pleasures. So today my spiritual life is successful and prosperous, extensive, popular, widespread, and well proclaimed wherever there are gods and humans. Of all the teachers in the world today, Chunda, I don't even see even a single one who has reached the peak of material possessions and fame like me." The Buddha's boasting about how much stuff he's been given. "Of all the spiritual communities and groups in the world today, I don't even see a single one who's reached the pinnacle of material possessions and fame like the mendicant Sangha." Just to note that the Buddha is noting this, but in other places he said that the gaining the great fame and material possessions will be the cause of corruption and decline of the Sangha. So he's not necessarily saying these are a good thing, but he's acknowledging that it's the reality that his religion or his path had become very popular. "If there was a spiritual path of which it may rightly be said that it's endowed with all good qualities, complete in all good qualities, neither too little nor too much, well explained, whole, full, and well propounded, it's of this spiritual path that this should be said." Okay, next passage is interesting, but I will just skip over it anyway. So, the next part. The Buddha says, "So Chunda, you should all come together and recite in concert, without disputing, those things I have taught you from my direct knowledge, comparing meaning with meaning and phrasing with phrasing, so that this spiritual path may last for a long time. That would be for the welfare and happiness of the people, for the benefit, welfare and happiness of gods and humans." So the Buddha is saying here that they, i.e. all those who he's just spoken of, remember he's just said this is what his teaching is, all of these people, he's gone on a great length to say it must be all of these things, otherwise it's incomplete. All of those must come together and recite these teachings together. And that would be, that's what the Buddha wanted them to do. "What are those things I've taught from my direct knowledge? They're the four kinds of mindfulness meditation, the four right efforts, the four bases of psychic power, the five faculties, the five powers, the seven awakening factors, and the Noble Eightfold Path. This is a collection of teachings known as the 37 awakening factors, and these are a summary of the Buddha's path and the Buddha's teachings." Now, so here the Buddha is clearly giving instructions about what he wants his community to do after he dies. This is what you should do. This is how, if you want the Dhamma to last for a long time, come together and recite these and get the meaning right and get the phrasing right. Now, after the Buddha in fact died, not long afterwards, but what happened wasn't quite like that. It was actually a bit different. Because where the Buddha is saying we had senior monks, middle monks, junior monks, senior nuns, middle nuns, junior nuns, celibate lay people, non-celibate lay people, celibate lay men and women, and non-celibate lay women, the celibate lay women weren't invited. The non-celibate lay women weren't invited. The celibate lay men were not invited. The non-celibate lay men were also not invited. The junior nuns were not invited. Middle nuns were not invited, and the senior nuns were not invited. The junior monks were not invited, and the middle monks were not invited. And even most of the senior monks were not invited, and only a small number of the senior monks were invited. Interesting, right? Yeah, interesting. So this has, in a way, set the course of the Buddhism since then. about that teaching, which the Buddha, as you see, the Buddha taught in such an expansive and inclusive way. Everyone is a part of it, and everyone is a part of what we're doing. So then afterwards, Venerable Mahakasapa decided, well, let's read the story about what happened. We are getting a bit late. It's now 9 o'clock. Do we have time?
Yes.
Or should we wrap up, or do we have to get up?
So first, because it's 9 o'clock, and of course if you want to leave, please leave anytime you want.
Yeah.
But then we've got two options. Either we can finish now in like a couple of minutes, and then we can have a tea if you want, and then we eat. Or we can stay a bit longer if you want. And because
well, look, I'll just take another. I'll take another 10 minutes.
Do we actually have a certain time?
Last year they were saying like something like 9:30, but I don't think there was any.
I'll wrap it up in 10 minutes.
Okay.
I'll wrap it up in 10 minutes.
You want a bit more? If you
yeah, no, no, it'll be good. 10 minutes is fine.
Maybe a few more, but
10 minutes is fine.
Yeah.
Well, we can hang around and chat afterwards, but we'll wrap up in 10 minutes.
Yeah.
Okay.
We can talk over tea then. We can continue over the tea. Oh, yeah, tea.
Yeah. So this is now telling the story of immediately after the Buddha passed away. And this whole story, and this whole narrative, the Mahaparinibbana Sutta, is a long, long discourse telling the last days and journeys of the Buddha. It's very moving and very powerful. And this is now continuing it with another narrative, what happened after the Buddha passed away. Mahakasapa, one of the great disciples of the Buddha, renowned for his ascetic practices, was walking along the road between Kusinara and Pava, came across a naked ascetic who was walking along with a flower that he'd picked up from the Buddha's funeral. And when they told when the monks heard that the Buddha had died, some of the monks were stretching forth their arms, they wailed, they fell down hurting themselves, they reeled backwards and forwards saying, "Too soon has the Lord attained Nibbana, too soon has the welfare attained Nibbana, too soon has the eye of the world disappeared." But those monks who are passionless, these, mindful and circumspect, bore it, saying, "Impermanent are compounded things. What is here possible because of this?" Actually, bad translation. How else could it be? What it means, something like that. Basically, what do you expect? Everything's impermanent. What do you expect to happen? Now, that is a crucial passage in understanding the whole history of Buddhism after that, right? We have this teaching that things are impermanent. Let it go. Yeah, this is what you think. But at the same time, not everyone is like that. And people have their very real passions and attachments. They're still, and they love the Buddha. And so this is that dichotomy. This is a narrative. And the narrative is setting up this dramatic tension. Right? This is what drives the narrative. Yeah. Anyway, so Kasapa. So then at the time there was another monk, an old monk called Subhadda, who when he heard that the Buddha died, he said, "Enough, your reverences, do not grieve, do not lament. We are well rid of this great recluse, because we used to be hassled, because he said, 'You can have this, this is not allowable.' But now we will be able to do as we like, and we won't do what we don't like." So Mahakasapa was not going to stand for that. Right? And he said, no, let us recite the Dhamma and the Vinaya before what is not Dhamma shines out and Dhamma is hidden. Okay? So he wanted to, so this is important context, right? So Mahakasapa, the most strict and ascetic of the monks, he was upset because the monks were going to just do what they wanted. That was his main concern. He wanted to keep the bad monks in control. And so the whole process became about a Sangha disciplinary matter, and it's included in the Buddhist monastic code. And again, this is clearly not what the Buddha was envisaging. He was envisaging reciting those teachings which are essential for awakening. He didn't say get together and recite long lists of rules after I've gone, right? He said get together and recite those things which are going to lead you to get enlightened. So Kasapa, anyway, they selected 500 arahants, 500 perfected ones, and they had a sanghakamma. The bold text here indicates a sanghakamma, that is a formal act of the monastic order. So this is that procedure became done like that. And they held a council to recite the Dhamma. And the account of that is all given there in the first council, and I won't go through all of the details there. But the main thing there is just to notice that, you know, the general idea of the council is, of course, what the Buddha said, but the way that it's carried out is quite different, and the spirit of it is quite different from what the Buddha apparently envisaged. And the fact that the texts retain those differences is one of the marks, one of the many, many marks of the authenticity of the text. Because it would have been very easy to go back and say, look, we'll just hack this a little bit, we'll just kind of tweak it, just adjust it to say that, oh yes, the arahants led by Kassapa should recite the Dhamma after I've gone, right? I mean, you just have to try to change a couple of lines in the suttas and you could do that, but that's not done. Actually, the description of the councils in the suttas is quite different from what actually happened in the Vinaya. So anyway, so that's the first council. But, you know, regardless of the qualms that we may have about exactly the process that was done there, the reality is that the councils were successful and that they did create that body of literature which has been passed down to the present. And of course, in any any worldly undertaking, you know, maintaining, passing down scriptures, it's a worldly undertaking. It's a physical, material thing. And anything like that, then there are going to be problems and there's going to be ambiguities and confusions and contradictions and all of those things. And there's going to be a lot of personal attachments and politics and all of that stuff gets involved. But something about it, at the heart of it, has maintained what I think is something really beautiful and really pure in terms of a spiritual path and a teaching that leads to liberation. And this is why the suttas are so important. Okay, so let's finish up. Let's have a break, and we'll hang around for a little while. So if anyone wants to have a chat or ask questions, then we can.
Thank you so much. Thank you. Thank you.